This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Frost Giants to Snow Queens, the frozen heart of speculative fiction.
So I'm going to spend the duration of this episode trying not to burst spontaneously into song. We all know the song I'm thinking of. I'm going to try not to, but you know, it's...
Just let it go, Madeleine.
Jules!
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
Shocked and appalled at you.
So I think this is actually because I was having a grumble about having to drive to work in the snow this week. And we didn't even have proper snow that really settled where I was living. But when I got to my workplace, there was just a little bit on the ground, just enough to make me a bit nervous. And the sky was absolutely full of it. And I was thinking, I really don't want that to come down before I go home, because I don't want to be, you know, I love working in a library. I just don't want to live there all weekend.
Yeah, we had a little sort of flurry here in Winchester as well. And I knew it wasn't going to settle. It just couldn't settle. But they were, the fact that like even my Facebook was just there like, it's going to be snowing tonight. We hope you're ready. And I'm like, ready for what?
They make it sound like you should be breaking out the emergency rations and blankets.
I know, and they were putting, and as we were driving past, they were putting grit on the road. I was just there like, what are you expecting? I'm worried because I'm still on crutches. I don't want to be in the snow on crutches.
I got to the library yesterday morning, and okay, it was pretty early still. It was 8 o'clock, but there was a guy with a truck and some grit, and I'm like, are you trying to work out whether or not you've got to grit my car park kind of thing? Because it's a private car park and I've got my own grit, but you know, if you want to do it, go ahead. Obviously, it all looks really pretty and everything, but we're just not... Everybody sort of... No, they encourage panic almost, don't they?
I think they do, yeah. But I think it's a very fundamental thing. And, you know, we touched on this very briefly in our Christmas episode. Or rather, our winter episode, I should say. And it's something about snow and ice and the cold grips us.
Yeah, definitely. There is a deep-seated, not quite fear, but a deep-seated wariness and anxiety there. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because when we were, you know, when early humans were living in caves, cold would kill you. I mean, cold still will kill you now, but cold would kill you a lot more readily.
Yeah.
So it's like that part of your brain that remembers being prey, I think.
Yeah. And also, I think that there's a rightful panic, especially about roads and stuff like that and ice, because it's the sudden removal of control.
I mean,
ice on a road is scary because you just suddenly don't have control over what's happening. And you realize that, you know, unlike when you fall on ice, you can put your hands out and protect yourself and stuff like that. When you're in a car, you're sort of just flailing a little bit, aren't you?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think sort of the ice and the snow sort of panics us a little bit. And it was all of these ice warnings and the snow warnings that prompted Jules and I to think about the other kinds of ice and snow warnings you can have, and the monsters that lurk in the ice and the snow, and some of the good things that perhaps lurk in the ice and snow. So we thought we'd talk about them today.
Yeah, and what archetypally ice and snow and extremes of cold weather have come to mean to us in the realm of narrative. So we've got probably a good place for us to start is fairy tales, because that's normally where we start.
Yeah.
But actually, to be fair, as humans with stories, that's normally where we all start, is folklore and fairy tales. You might not realise it, but we do.
That's a very classic line. And so we start, as humanity always has, with fairy tales.
Are we getting even more British as we get older?
Christ, hang on a second. You're at least 10 years older than me. This is
Yeah,
This
but
is
I
a little
stopped
bit.
aging at 30, so we're good.
Yeah,
It's
and no, but I'm
fine.
just saying that if we're getting even more British when we get older, I don't want to imagine what I'll be like when I'm 90. Just
Oh, we'll
meaner.
have colonized a country somewhere.
Course we
And we'll
will.
have told ourselves it was the right things
It was
to
the right thing to do. We were celebrating British sensibilities.
do.
Yeah, I'll have a mustache and a top hat and a monocle. It'll be great.
Anyway, moving aside from that, let's look at the Snow Queen to start with. So, a classic Hans Christian and Andersen.
Sorry, that sounds like you said a classic Hans Christian and Andersen.
And Andersen Shelter. Hans Christian Andersen, The Snow Queen, in which you've got Greta, who goes after Kai, who is taken by the Snow Queen.
I will confess, I've never read it.
Oh, that's one of the really good ones. So it's definitely worth a read.
Very well.
Very well, so we should go away and read that one. I think really the Snow Queen herself, for all her sort of driving around on her sleigh with either her white horses or white reindeer, it's usually white horses, I think. She really just is the personification of winter, and winter is always in a way seeking its own destruction in spring or in something warm. But the Snow Queen steals young men, particularly handsome young men, mostly in the Hans Christian and Hans, God, I can't say it, Hans Christian Andersen version. Mostly in that version, the Snow Queen is looking for a young man to help her put together the mirror that was created in hell, because it will give her lots of power. And that's something, strangely enough, that you do find in a lot of frozen fairy tales, if you like, is the fact you will get a lot of mirrors and a lot of glass. But we'll come to that in a minute. I always found the Snow Queen quite an eerie story. Obviously, really enjoyed it, fascinated by it, but there's something very other and very not quite frightening. I don't want to say chilling, so I'm not punning, but basically something a little bit disturbing about this creature who looks so human and yet at the same time clearly does not have any range of human emotion at all, is as indifferent to you as a mountain.
Yeah, and I think that is the interest an interesting character trait, not just with the various depictions of the Snow Queen, but various depictions of sort of ice monsters and the supernatural which are associated with winter and ice and snow, is that they have that quality in common, and that they're cold. And again, that's I'm not saying that as in they're cold. I'm saying that they are cold characters usually. They're quite indifferent, they're quite detached. And there's a harshness about it. There's a beauty usually about them, and there's a harshness about them which isn't cruel, it's just stark.
Yeah, and you can no more be angry or resentful at them for being what they are than you can be angry or resentful at winter for being what it is, because it just simply is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did always like the Snow Queen, and I think it is interesting that how it all falls out in the end is Greta does manage to rescue Kai and get him back, because he becomes very inhuman and very cold and very shut off as well. It takes Greta, quite a bit of courage to be able to sort of confront him and get him to come back emotionally as much as physically.
Yeah.
And the Snow Queen isn't so much defeated as she sort of gives way to spring. So it is a very classic seasonal tale. Other stories that I like one of this is one of my absolute favourite fairy tales actually, is East of the Sun, West of the Moon, which in many versions has one of the stupidest heroines you could possibly find. Are you familiar with that one?
And no, I'm not.
Okay, I think it's Norwegian originally, and it's a girl who is living, who, her family is relatively poor. She's the eighth child, and she's the youngest, and she's also one of the more adventurous ones. And one
Right.
day, out in the early winter, a white bear comes out of the wilderness, knocks on the door, as bears do in Norway.
Yeah. Casual bear day.
And her family's in debt, and he said, "Well, you know what? I'll pay all your debts, but you must give me your
Hang on a
youngest daughter."
second. Hang on. I was willing to sort of accept the bear knocking on the door, but it's the fact that the bear knocking on the door was apparently more shocking to you than the fact that he stopped by and said, "Well, I see you're in debt. So, let's make a deal." That's the bit I would have remarked upon as being casual bear behavior.
Well, In all fairness, it's where you find your shock value, isn't it? I mean, the bear knocking on the door in the first place, and I'm kind of like, okay, well, if I'm going to accept that, I'll accept everything that comes after it.
No, I can accept that a real bear might knock on a door. I cannot accept that a real bear might come in and say, "Have you filed your tax returns?"
Going to let me finish this?
Yes, sorry, continue.
So the bear somehow makes chests of wealth appear so that they can pay off their debts because, it's been a very hard year and there's lots
I
of children.
sense this may be a magic bear.
Do you think? And the
Maybe.
youngest daughter agrees to go with the bear for a year and a day. And the terms of the agreement are that, she'll just be like a companion and not in a weird way. He takes her away to this fabulous palace, basically. And so she spends all her days with the bear, talking to him, and he gradually starts to become a little bit more communicative because he's still very much a bear, despite the whole magical wealth and everything. But at night, she is somewhat disturbed, as you would be, by the fact that she gets into bed, and just as she's getting off to sleep, the door opens and it's pitch black, and someone else comes and gets into the other side of the bed. Nothing happens, ever. It's just a case of she can't see who it is that she's sharing a bed with at night. Yes, which is where it sounds a little bit creepy, but and she isn't able to light a light or anything. And one of the terms of the contract, if you like, with her parents are that she will not try and light a candle after she's gone to bed. As it turns out, that doesn't matter because she's not able to. Anyway, she gets really homesick, and the bear says, "Okay, I'll take you home for a visit." So she's allowed to go home for a week, and she tells her mother about this person getting into bed with her and says, "Nothing's happening, but I'm kind of freaked out by the fact I can't see who it is." And her mother meets a peddler at the market who sells her a magic candle. And the girl lights the candle to see who's got into bed with her. So, once again, female curiosity is causing the downfall.
Of
And
course,
she
naturally.
sees the most beautiful young man sleeping in the bed next to her. And then he wakes up, sees she's lit a candle, and sort of goes, oh bugger, kind of thing. And the troll queen turns up and takes him away. And then that's when the story really starts because the girl has to go through all these trials to get her prince back. The prince is obviously the bear, but he can only be a bear when he's around her. She had to live with him for a year and a day to break the spell, but her curiosity got the better of her, and now he has to marry the troll queen. You sound That silence is almost skeptical.
Well, why did he get into the bed? Did he have to sleep in the bed beside her? Or was he just being a creep?
No, he wasn't being a creep. This is part because the troll queen's the one who turned him into a bear because he didn't want to marry her because she's a troll.
Fair enough.
And she said, "Okay, well, I'll give you a chance to win your freedom because generally in fairy tales you can't curse someone without giving them a chance to break it." And part of it was, you have to live with a girl almost as if you're married, but without any of the, usual married stuff, which includes sharing a bed at night.
Oh, how interesting.
Yes.
Ah, I like it. I like it.
Anyway, there's been three really good adaptations of this in book form. There's Northchild by Edith Pateau, very, very good. A bit more of a traditional telling of it. There is Ice by Sarah Beth Durst, which is a really, really good retelling of it. She's an only child in that version, and she's part of a conservation effort to save polar bears. And her mother was the daughter of the North Wind, and but she fell in love with her father. And one of the spirits of the ice, who takes the form of a polar bear, said, "Okay, well, I'll help you be with the man you love, but in return, you must give me your daughter." And at the time, she wasn't even married to him, so she's like, "Yeah, okay, fine, have my kid," because apparently that's what you do. And then the bear turns up on the girl's 18th birthday to claim her, and the girl's, really quite tomboyish and doesn't want to go to the mainland, wants to continue working on the conservation effort on the ice with the polar bear, and sort of goes along with him to start with, and is a bit sort of pissed off about the whole thing. She's been sold into marriage with a polar bear, despite the fact she likes them. But then gradually they sort of become friends, and then she sort of falls in love with him, and the same thing once again. As long as she's not looking at him, he can be human. And then she does the same. She creates the same mistake whereby she lights a candle at night. There are circumstances around why she does that. It's a bit more understandable. And the troll queen turns up and takes him away. And once again, you have the same thing. But it's set in the modern day, so it's really, really good. And then a slight twist on it by Jessica Day George called Sun and Moon, Ice and Snow. And it's about a girl who, as the eighth child in the family, her mother is so disgusted that she's had eight children, she refuses to give the girl a name. So she goes on a, yeah, she goes on a quest to get herself named and ends up helping the polar bear. Well, the white bear, but it's probably a polar bear. And saving him from the troll queen once again. So, yeah.
Again, that we're it's a I mean it has a very a rings quite similar to Beauty and the Beast in some respects.
Yes, yeah, of that class of fairy tale.
But actually, I'm getting a real vibe of A Court of Thorns and Roses here.
It may well have inspired it.
More than perhaps Beauty and the Beast in some respects. Sort of.
Yeah, but it's always very atmospheric because it's, you know, set in very, very hard conditions as well, with the ice and the snow. Which is something that is worth looking at fairy tale wise, because when you have, you know, the predominant presence of ice and snow in a fairy tale, and then things start to shift, usually the ice and snow means there's a change within the character. And if the snow and ice is melting, then there's a good chance the characters are falling in love. And if the ice is forming or the snow is coming in, then usually that means the character has been cheated in some way, or is becoming selfish and hard, or, you know, caving to sort of a very toxic form of grief.
There's another interesting thing about Monsters of the Ice, and it's the relationship between ice monsters and men. And when I say men, I mean men as in the gender, not men as in human beings. And you get that across the board. Just as the Ice Queen steals handsome young men, there is a relationship between men in particular being targeted in fairy tales, usually more than women by these monsters.
Yeah, certainly the female ones, and a lot of them are personified as being female presences as well, that which is quite interesting. Winter is quite often personified as being female.
Which is very, very interesting. And actually another reason why it's interesting is that if we think of the seasons as being personifications of what they can do. It's interesting that we've got winter as female when spring and summer are the bearers of life.
Yeah, I mean, really, summer is sort of the pinnacle, isn't it? It's summer's when it's already got started, and summer's always, in most of the myths and legends I've read, has been always been personified as being quite male or masculine.
But it is quite interesting in that respect that actually the cold is female, not the bearer of life, but the thing that stops everything, the
Yeah.
changeover.
Although you need the cold in order to check, you know, you literally need cold in order for seeds to be able to germinate. There's I actually can't remember the term, but there is a particular temperature that must be hit in order for the seeds to then germinate the following spring.
And it's another interesting thing is that we've mentioned the relationship between the cold and death. And I think, as we've said, it's fairly obvious that when it's cold, people die. Just as when it's hot, people die. But especially across, Europe and places where the cold is very, very bad. But yeah, the cold has an association with death because a lot of people die when it's cold.
I mean, it
But
doesn't even have to be especially like glacial. People die of exposure in Britain if they're in the wrong place.
yeah, exactly. And yet there's another kind of association with death as well. And it's not just that people die. It goes sort of beyond that in some ways. And I wonder whether there isn't actually something to do with preservation in the way that the cold preserves things.
See, that's interesting, and that sort of brings me on to Snow White, strangely enough. So bear with me here. But obviously you've got things like permafrost in sort of just inside the Arctic Circle, where if you bury something in it won't decay. So you could, you know, they have bodies there from thousands of years. Well, obviously they've dug up mammoths almost in their entirety, but there's bodies there that contain things like the plague. Nothing dies in it. You know, so everything, all the microbes, all the diseases and everything are preserved along with the body and the flesh and the hair and everything. And interestingly, we all know the story of Snow White, and obviously there's the dwarves think she's dead, so they put her in a glass coffin, as you would. But an older story version of that I'd heard, they actually put her in a coffin made of ice. So what if they were trying to preserve her remains because she was so beautiful?
Yeah.
Which would make a bit more sense in a way. And also sort of steers us away from the whole necrophilia aspect, which would be good.
Well, I mean, just because she's frosty doesn't mean it's not necrophilia, but
Well, yeah,
I'm
but
just saying.
unless they thought, well, she will die, but maybe if we put her in the ice, she won't die, it's the whole preserving thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's all that story is ultimately very, very creepy, but it is interesting that you have that together. And once again, you've got ice and or glass there, which shows transformation. And not to put too fine a point on it, the transformation in Snow White is not from her being a dead girl into being an alive girl. It's from her being a girl who doesn't know anything about sex into a girl who does.
Yeah. The interesting thing about it is that in some of the original versions of Snow White, it's not that the kisses her, and not that the prince kisses her and wakes her up. It's that he actually has sex with her and she births several children whilst still asleep.
I haven't read that. That's more Sleeping Beauty. I've read that. It's The Sun and Moon and Talia, which is a horrific story.
I may be mixing things up. Sorry.
But in Snow White, he sees her, and in the really old versions of it, he sees her and orders her body to be brought up to his rooms, and then locks himself in with her for 7 days. And then, strangely enough, she comes down alive. But you're thinking, to all intents and purposes, you just locked yourself in your rooms with a dead girl. For a week.
Well, we were talking about the cold needing to germinate seeds.
It's all very creepy. So anyway.
Tis, tis. But yeah, but there is something about the preservation, which is that it's not just that something's dead, it's that something's dead and yet it's not gone. Which I think is why we don't only have an association with the dead with the winter, but we have an association with ghosts and things coming back. Because of that, it's gone, but it's not actually gone. It's not returning to the earth. It is preserved. It remains as if at any moment it could just rise back up again. And it's why, other than the biological sense, to it, which is that when things are dead, they go cold. But it's why you often have this association with the cold and dead. Ghosts are cold. Ghosts have cold spots. There's the death cold. And then you have a lot of folklore about creatures, such as in Japanese folklore, there's the Yukiona, who's the snow woman, who's usually a woman who died in the snow. And she comes back, and again, she comes after men, usually because it's their fault that she's dead, so kudos. And she come after them. And in fact, we've got our own myth like that in Winchester. There's a tavern here called the Hyde Tavern. It's very, very old, and it's haunted by several ghosts, supposedly. And one of the ghosts that is haunting it is a woman who died of the cold outside. I might be mixing up stories because there are so many. Apparently there are, I think there are about three ghosts there, so like I don't know whether what's causing what, but so far as I understand, it's that a woman was left outside to die. She wasn't permitted to come inside, so she died of the co of exposure outside. And now in the middle of the night, the story goes that she will pull off your bed sheets while you're trying to sleep, to expose you basically, to make you feel cold as well. And yeah, it's this the idea that if you die in the cold, you don't actually ever really die, you linger.
Which actually, I'll do a little sidestep away from fairy tales for a moment. There's a book that I read just the end of last year called Thin Air by Michelle Paver, and it's a ghost story. And it actually had a paragraph in it that disquieted me, which is great.
Ooh.
Which I obviously can't quote for you, but
That's
the
good, because if it disquieted you, I'd be like out of sleeping for a week. Sorry, just a small, this is a small little anecdote, little side note. Jules recently was writing something with me, and she said, well, or rather, she was writing something. She sent me a chapter, and I went, "Whew, gosh, that last chapter was quite scary." And Jules went, "Really? I didn't think it was too bad. I wasn't going for scary." And I was like, "Oh yeah, nothing scary about something crawling out of a well to get you. Nothing scary at all, Jules." And apparently she was oblivious to that. So yeah, anecdote finished, but Jules is into scary stuff. I am not. Moving on.
I don't know if I'm into scary stuff. I think I'm searching for fear quite a lot of the
What's wrong with you? I crave fear.
I keep reading these things. I keep finding books on Amazon and reading them, and they're advertised as ghost stories. And I read them, and I'm like, "That's not scary. Why isn't it scary? That's just you've mentioned a ghost, and it's supposed to be scary. But where's the tent?" Anyway, that's obviously my issue. This book, Thin Air, did actually have some genuinely quite freaky moments. It's about a team of mountaineers. Set in the early 20th century, and what they're trying to do is climb K2, which is part of the Himalayas. K2 isn't as tall as Everest, but in some ways it's supposed to be a much more challenging climb. Certainly the last segment is very, very difficult. I don't know how much you or anyone else knows about mountaineering, but
Little
once you get to a certain level with altitude sickness, you start to hallucinate. And obviously, you're constantly being assailed by the cold because it is always it's permanently under ice and snow up there, so it's very, very difficult living conditions. And they're following the path of an expedition that failed something like 20 or 30 years before. And in that expedition, three people were lost. Now, two of them were recovered and brought down the mountain and buried, but one person was never ever recovered. And the person who's telling this story gradually starts to, I mean, he starts off as a total non-believer. He gradually gets quite creeped out, and then it gets worse. And he's sure he can hear something outside they build ice caves. He's sure he can hear something outside them at night. And he becomes so determined to do the final stretch with the others. And he's not a lifelong mountaineer like the rest of them. Not so much because he wants the summit in the same way, but because he doesn't want to be left alone with the ice caves. And he's the doctor on the expedition as well, which is also part of why he's so necessary. And right up until this paragraph, you genuinely don't know whether it's just altitude sickness or whether there is something really out there. Anyway, I won't spoil it in case anyone wants to go and read it. It is a very good story, and as I said, it had a paragraph that was genuinely quite scary. But it's that whole idea of being enclosed in a cold with the mountain, and the mountain just doesn't care. You're a gnat, you're a flea, you're less significant than that.
It's my dad climbs mountains. It's his thing. He's actually doing Everest base camp soon because why not? Just a small thing. My dad is going to be 61 in in March. So yeah, he climbs mountains. He's climbed Mont Blanc twice. The second time he went up, they were like, "You're back." People don't usually come back. But yeah, he's all about climbing mountains, and he suffers from a little bit of altitude sickness, and he suffered from it when he was, I think, the first time he did Mont Blanc. And so I've studied it, and I listened to his stories about sort of the mountains and why. I mean, they're terrifying. Climbing mountains is actually quite scary. It's a very frightening experience. And there's this other thing, which is that if all you see is snow and snow and snow and snow and snow, it really is kind of blinding, actually. And it's very easy. People who suffer from migraines often get, oh, I've just forgotten the word. But you know, when you start seeing patterns and things like
Like
that in
an
your
aura.
eyes?
Like an aura.
Yeah, an aura. That's right, aura. You get that from being out on the snow all day. So it's and so even without the altitude sickness, it's very easy to start seeing things. And funnily enough, actually, I remember the first time I encountered a mountain monster, as it were. And that sorry, that's not to say I actually, I was just walking across the mountain one day and a yeti jumped out at me. We were skiing when I was kids, when we were kids, when I was kids. Good English. And there was this, and I can't remember where we were, but there was this huge rock that was shaped like a giant frog.
Yeah.
It was shaped like the giant frog, and our ski instructor told us, you know, to all of our delight, that it slept during the day, but at night it moved and would hop across the beast looking for skiers who hadn't got down in time or who were lost on the mountain, and they would eat them. And like, I was 100% ready to believe that this, it was a pretty intimidating, and when I say it was a rock, I mean like this, it was a huge chunk of the mountain actually that was sticking out. You know, it was about, you know, 7 meters high, if you know, if not a bit bigger than that. It was a pretty big thing.
Yeah.
And it did look a lot like this rather grotesque, mean looking frog, which I was, as I said, very willing to believe at that age that that thing did get up. And I got really excited by it. I got excited. I started making stories about how this frog, you know,
Yeah.
could never come down to the town, but yeah, it did roam the beasts at night. I don't know why it was a frog, but it was a frog.
There is something, I found this when I was in Norway, but there's something when you go out in the sort of countryside around the mountains and the fjords, you can see why the legends of things like trolls and Huldra and Draug did actually evolve. There is a genuine feeling. I was walking along, it would have been a stream that was running off of a glacier down to a fjord, and there was a little wooden bridge going over it, and I immediately thought, oh, that's so cute, you know, Billy Goat's Gruff. And it was absolutely beautiful, and there were all these white flowers springing out of the ground, and I was completely by myself, and the air was really cold and still, and the sky was bright blue, and I sat there for a bit, and after a while I started to get this sense of otherness, this sense of unreality. And I can't actually explain what happened, but I heard tap, 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 like footsteps on this little wooden bridge, and I turned and there was nothing there. So I continued sitting there. I was sat there with a sketchbook actually. And a bit later again, tap, 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 tap. I was like, okay, that's slightly eerie now. So I turned so I could actually see the bridge, thought I may as well sketch the bridge. And you know, as I was looking at it again, I could hear this tap, 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 tap. I was like, I mean, I don't know, maybe there was a woodpecker somewhere, but it wouldn't have been, there weren't really any real trees, so it was really quite strange. But what I did find fascinating, I wouldn't say I was really freaked out, it was more a case of, I'm a bit wary because that's not, I don't know where the noise is coming from. But what I found fascinating was the fact that I was sat there thinking, I can genuinely see where they get the feeling of these folk tales and legends from now, because it feels like this should be the sort of country where something just lumbers out of the hills and it wouldn't be peculiar.
Yeah, I would have been out of there by then, by
No,
that point.
I even crossed the bridge to go back, but
Damn it, Jules!
so if there's
After
something
all
under the
you've
bridge.
read, you'd have thought you'd learnt.
Bridges are crossing places. You're supposed to be safe, according to folklore. So we'll see.
Oh.
Anyway, nothing grabbed me. I was almost disappointed.
Oh, what?
So, looking at some of the, the Norse. Not going too much into Norse legend because I think we should do an episode just on that. But some of the little bits and pieces around that, like things like the Fimbulvint, which is the Great Winter.
Say that fast 5 times over.
Yeah, good luck with that. Now the Fimbulvint is what it is, this great crushing winter that is supposed to happen right before the day of Ragnarok, as in, the ice comes in, the snow comes in, you can't get out anywhere, there's hunger, there's cold, and it sounds horrific, but at the same time I've always, even as a child, found it just a little bit thrilling as well, sort of like the end of the world, it's cold. But it's reflected again and again in stories where we have nuclear winters and things like that.
Yeah.
And it may have been influenced by one of the mini ice ages that happened in 535 BCE,
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
which would make sense. And I suppose it's echoed in things like in 1814 when they had the year without a summer, again, mini ice age or the end of one. And where basically Mount Tambora erupted, and there was so much ash in the atmosphere that the summer was just really cold and stormy the whole time. And then you've got things like the Jotun, or the ice giants, traditionally found on Jotunheim, strangely enough, which is one of the nine Asgardian worlds, nine worlds of the Norse mythology.
From Yggdrasil.
Yeah, that's the one. Weirdly, I suppose the easiest way would be to say that the Jotun were sort of roughly equivalent with the Titans in some ways, although they weren't so diversified in their powers. And they were banished to Jotunheim after, this would be after Odin had slept with a few and got a few of them pregnant because they were a threat to Asgard. But then, if you are going to go around sleeping with lots of different women and getting them pregnant, particularly big, strong giantesses, then they're going to get annoyed with you, probably.
Probably a little bit, yeah. Smooth, Odin, smooth. And yeah, they are interesting because again we have another association there, which is the association between ice and magic. Which actually I think if there's any association of magic with any season, I mean there's magic associated with every season. But there is a strong thing about winter and magic.
Yeah, and it is noticeable with particularly the female Jotun, which is the fact that they were supposed to have the power of augury by looking into water, particularly frozen water. So the ice or a frozen lake would act like a mirror. So once again, you have ice, glass, mirror.
Yeah, which brings us all the way back to and reflections.
Yeah, that's right.
Reflections and ice. So let's talk about mirrors a little bit.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, mirrors are another thing which appear a lot, usually to do with villains.
Yeah.
So we have the mirror in the Ice Queen, which is the mirror from Hell that she wants. You have the mirror in Snow White.
yeah which is it's neither good nor bad. It just houses a spirit that it'll tell you the truth, and mirrors traditionally do tell you the truth.
Because and that's two things with mirrors, which is that mirrors tell the truth, mirrors show the truth, which is why you can't see reflections of vampires in mirrors and stuff like that. So mirrors tell the truth. And mirrors trap things.
Yeah, which obviously, this being from Irish extraction, it's traditional to drape all the mirrors when somebody dies, and obviously to leave a window open, which sounds very silly, but that's what you do.
All I can imagine is a soul like behaving like a fly that's trapped inside, just bzz, 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 come on.
I will tell you some of the ghost stories my grandmother told me at some point.
Oh, yes, I think we should just have an episode about your grandmother's ghost stories.
Sure what she'd have thought
Halloween special. It's just going to be story time with Jules
that.
telling ghost stories and me reacting to it
There are
loudly.
going to be so many complaints as well.
I don't know. If you guys would like to hear Jules sit down for an episode and tell us her grandmother's ghost stories.
Let's find out
Write
what I've
in
got.
to Dissecting Dragons today.
Sorry, back to mirrors.
No, I'm done.
Talking about mirrors, but I think it is interesting, obviously, that you've got ice that shows that it's basically representative of a transformative state in folklore and fairy tales, and you've got mirrors which reflect the truth. Ice is often used as a mirror as well, or great bodies of cold water again, and the two aren't so much used interchangeably, but one seems to be a progression of the other.
It is actually, yeah. And it's also silver.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because obviously early mirrors were made of silver or bronze that was really highly polished. They weren't made of glass because that was expensive.
Yes. So, we have silver. And again, that is associated with winter, possibly because of the color. But interestingly enough, silver is also something which is used in folklore, often against bad spirits.
Yeah.
And that again, it's interesting that it's associated both with winter and with magic, and also as a defense against evil things. Because very often, and I find this very often, the magical creatures that we get the winter or from the ice are not evil. They're just, yeah, as we said, they're just cold.
Yeah, they just are. They're beyond human ken.
And they also actually tend to, they're very stubborn usually, but they don't put up that much of a fight when their time has actually come.
No, it is very much a sense of we are, we're a necessary part of the cycle of life and death.
Yeah. So, I think it's only fair that we talk about Frozen.
You've been dying to since we started.
That being said, I should point out, I finally watched Moana.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll do an episode on Moana because it's the total inverse of Frozen. Absolutely beautiful, but irrelevant right now. So we'll talk about Frozen this time, but I just want to let our listeners know we are progressing. Frozen is interesting because originally Elsa was going to be that ice queen that we're more familiar with.
Yeah.
And obviously the story developed, and some people weren't that fond of that. And I would be very interested, because they're making a sequel, I would be very interested if they went into how Elsa got her powers.
Well, in some ways, I mean, I think they covered it well enough with she comes by it naturally. She just happened to be born a bit different.
Yeah, but it would be interesting to sort of say a little bit more backstory into that. I wouldn't mind if it linked in a little bit more to the myth, if we got the mirror, if we had something like that in the sequel.
Yeah.
Because
The mirror is actually quite terrifying. It's
what
the
is the mirror?
Mirror was created in hell by the devil, and the idea was this was one of the devil's greatest tricks. He created a mirror that would not tell the truth, but would reflect everything back subtly distorted. And then he called on his demons to fly up to heaven with it and show it to God so God could see his own reflection and see that he wasn't great and that his very goodness and righteousness were actually evils in themselves. But before the demons managed to get that far, the angels caught them and threw them again out of heaven, and the mirror shattered. And all, as it fell down to earth, and all the bits and pieces fell everywhere, but some of them fell into the hearts and eyes of human men. So part of the reason the Snow Queen was collecting men was in order to get all the shards of glass. And the reason Kai was so suitable was not just because he was very good at putting puzzles together, but it was also because the very, very last tiny splinter had fallen into his eye and worked its way to his heart. And he very nearly completes the mirror, just apart from this tiny last little sliver, but it's going to kill him.
So what does she actually want the mirror for?
The mirror itself contains great power, I think, but I think she also sort of wants to do pretty much what the mirror was intended for and say, look, the way you've created things and then arranged things is actually wrong. You're not, you've done this and you've said it's natural order and this isn't how natural order should be. It's
Mm.
a bit sketchy, but some interpretations have certainly taken it in that direction. So yeah, the scariest thing about the Snow Queen was that mirror, that artifact. It's not good or bad, but it is subtly distorted. You might look into it as a decent person and find out that actually you're wrong.
That's ugh, how creepy. Oh.
But wouldn't you be very, very curious?
No.
Wouldn't you be so curious that you might have to look anyway?
No, like not even a little bit.
Well, Pandora's box would be safe with you, wouldn't
Well,
it?
no, that's different. That's different. Because I presume that the thing about Pandora's box is that you sort of she didn't know what was in it. If
Maybe she was
someone
just
said,
told
"This is a
not to
magic
open it.
mirror," if someone handed me the mirror and said, "This is a magic mirror, don't look into it, you'll see something," then absolutely yes, I'd be like, "Ah, well, what am I going to see?" I definitely want to see. If someone gave me a mirror and said, "This is a mirror of deception, it will probably screw you up if you look into it, don't," I'll go, "Yeah, that's fair. Fair, that's fair." I wouldn't do it, in the same way that if someone hands me a needle and says, "Don't inject this into yourself."
Don't touch the spinning wheel. Don't light the candle after dark.
See, the problem with all of these fairy tales is that explanations are needed. Here's a magic mirror, don't look into it. Then you're definitely going to look into it. Here's do not light a candle after dark. You could have just said, "Don't light a candle after dark." Or she could have just said, next morning, she said, Someone crawled into my bed last night. Who was it? Don't worry, it's just me. I won't touch you. Okay.
I think he's not allowed to tell her.
Yeah, but he. Okay, so. All right. Well, she could have at least mentioned it to him. She said someone crawled into bed last night, and he could have said, don't worry about it.
Yeah, good point. But no one ever explains things to girls in fairy tales, if you
Yeah.
noticed.
Yeah, no one ever explains things to girls, and then they get angry when girls do things which are just literally natural. I mean, if someone crawled into my bed who I wouldn't know, I wouldn't just lie there, I'd stab them.
Yeah, I have to say that my reaction would not be to lie there thinking, "Who's that?"
To be honest, I've shared my bed with, with my partner, and I've woken up sort of forgetting sometimes, especially when we first started dating and I wasn't used to sharing a bed. And then my partner would be there and I'd wake and I'd be like, who the? Oh, it's fine.
Oh, it's you. That's
It's
okay.
fine. He's allowed. He's allowed in here.
To be honest, my cat's totally freaked me out in the night by deciding that then was the time she should come and like start kissing my nose or something.
Oh.
There's like there's something really furry brushing. Oh, it's the cat.
Yeah, see, if something happened to me like that, I'd be a little more alarmed because I don't actually own a pet. So that's fair. But yeah, this is why I can't write fairy tales, because if I was writing a fairy tale with her and there she is and someone crawls into the bed, she'd just go, no. And then you'd just feel them leaving the bed and that would be that.
Yeah. Okay,
Yeah,
I just want
that's
to talk about a series that I've been watching with my other half
go on.
recently. It's called Fortitude, and I haven't got to the end, and I don't know. It could be something that's speculative in a science fiction way. It could be speculative in a, ooh, there's weird mojo going on type way. Or it could be just a murder mystery set in the Arctic Circle, because we haven't got far enough to really know. But it's got that same sort of enclosed, almost claustrophobic, locked in the ice feeling. And it's really great. It's got this great cast of characters. There's lots of secrets. And it does have an almost Stephen King or The Thing type feel, whereby you have a small town in sort of very, very northern Norway. And you have lots of different people from different cultures who all happen to be there. And you get the sense that maybe some of them are running away from things, because otherwise, why would you choose to live somewhere where you have sort of like 6 weeks of darkness every year, and there's never anything growing, it's always locked with ice, it's always snow. And it's the
Yeah.
same thing with there's something is discovered in the permafrost, and then people start to act strangely, and then somebody dies, and they're trying to investigate, and then somebody else comes in, but you have to wonder about his motives as well.
Yeah.
It's really, really good. I highly recommend people trying it.
Oh, I might check it out. You can come back. You'll have to come back and tell us whether it was speculative fiction in the end. Oh, I guess you can't, because that would be a spoiler.
I mean, I'm going to call it speculative at the moment because it feels like it is, but it might genuinely just be a murder mystery, I suppose.
Yeah, the odd thing about it is that when you do get small knit communities like that, especially when you get small knit communities in places of natural power,
Yeah.
so in the middle of the in the places which are on moors, villages that are on moors by the sea or kind of on mountains and stuff like that, just tend to be more superstitious, and I can completely understand why.
Yeah.
It's actually just. It just makes sense with the way that human mind works. I can understand why exactly. We're gonna have to wrap it up now, I
Yes,
think.
we are.
But before we do, I have to ask you a question.
Okay.
What do you think of yetis?
I think we should talk about them in an episode dedicated to cryptids,
Yes, I agree, but I
because
just.
I've got way too much to say about them.
Do you, just okay, just to summarize very quickly then, do you like yetis?
I don't know if "like's" the right word. I find the whole idea quite fascinating.
See, that's interesting because they really bore me.
They bore you.
Yeah.
Do the great apes bore you?
In terms of cryptids and stuff like that, I'm really not that interested by Bigfoot and Yetis.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily fetch me either, but I do find it interesting. It's one of the best documented ones, the ones where all they really need to complete the evidence is a living or a dead sample. So, but anyway, we'll talk about that another time.
That's why we didn't talk about it in this episode. I'm not taken by it. I'm not convinced. It's not weird enough.
It's not weird enough. So your problem is not that they don't exist, but that they're not weird enough.
It's just not weird enough. It's not obscure enough for me.
That's
It's
brilliant.
too
Okay.
plausible.
We'll break this down another time.
And on that
We'll see you next week.
thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.